The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I would like to pick up the theme for that day long as the topic for this morning. And as I started the talk yesterday, I'll start it this way with an analogy. I've lived here on the peninsula now for about 25 years, and a good amount of time, about 7 years, up in the mountains up here, on the top of Skyline, in the woods. And I've lived with my wife, who is a botanist, and she worked professionally in those mountains as a botanist doing plant surveys. So she knows these plants very well. And we've done a lot of hiking together and alone in these mountains and hills. And I love it and love the nature here. And amazingly enough, especially living with a botanist, I haven't really learned the plants of these hills for most of that time. And it was kind of like just a blur of plants. You know, I knew there were trees, and I knew there were bushes, and I knew there were little, you know, flowers, and I did learn what some of the invasive weeds were, French broom and thistles, and I knew a little bit, but, you know, I didn't really know much, and I was quite content. You know, I loved being in nature and being out there, but I didn't know. And then about a month ago, she's back for a little while from her big hike that she's doing. And she, we were going in regularly up to walking in the hills, and I started to ask her about the plants. And I found myself quite interested in them, and kind of amazed that it took this long. And was quite struck by the difference between how it used to be, which I was quite content, and what it's like now. And so I'm still learning. There's a lot to learn, boy. But, now I can identify the predominant trees, the different kinds of oaks. And I can identify, some of the chaparral and the bushes and some of the, plants and flowers. And as, some of the trees now I can identify by their bark. I don't have to even look up at the canopy because the bark is distinctive. And as I'm learning more and more about them, I'm also getting curious about, well, what uses do these have? And so I'm reading a little bit about the Native American uses and the early Spanish settlers and how they used the different plants and what they did and with them. And I find it fascinating. And now when I go into the woods up here, I find my attention is heightened. And I'm much less likely to contentedly drift off and think about things as I'm walking. Now I'm very attentive and just love kind of noticing what's around me and noticing the different plants and different things. And things stand out and highlight, and I notice things about the vegetation, about the local little climate zones and how things shift and change. And the world's come kind of alive in a very different way, and I have a kind of delightful, heightened attention to my environment as I walk now and find myself increasingly curious about what's around me. And so that's nice. Well, the same thing can happen with our minds in meditation. And I think some meditators can spend 25 years. It's all a blur in there. And they have generally know a little bit about it. We know a little bit about the invasive weeds, the destructive thoughts that come in, and we know that we should pull them out and not get caught up in them and let go of them, come back to the present moment. And that's helpful, and we calm down. And in the blur of just going for our meditative hike in our minds, it's all kind of just nice. It's, a blur of things in there. But we know some of the highlights. We know that we're getting calmer or more steady, or some general sense of what it's about. It's also possible to become cognizant, to be able to identify the different species in there, the different elements of the mind, the qualities of mind, and be able to kind of, you know, and we have an amazingly rich, complex inner life that is probably, in terms of the highlights of what you really need to know, a lot fewer things than going up to one of these nature preserves here. One of the books that we have for the plants in one of the preserves has 400 plants. So if you want to learn all the plants, that's a lot to learn. I'm kind of a little bit intimidated by it. But to learn your mind, luckily you don't have to learn 500 items. There's actually a few, it's a simpler ecosystem, believe it or not. But it is possible to learn more about what's going on in there and the different elements, what comes into play. And if you do that as you meditate, the meditation becomes richer. There's things become more noticeable. You're more engaged. You're more involved with yourself and meditation, and becomes more interesting because it's not just simply I'm either calm or not calm or something. I'm either distracted or not distracted, and it becomes a very appealing inner world to get to know and explore. And I think of it as an ecosystem. I think, our inner life is just as much part of the natural world as being out and walking in the preserves. And if you want to kind of be in awe or be inspired by nature, take a walk in your mind. Take a walk in your inner life and get to know it and know what's going on there. So one of the things that I wanted to highlight about what we can get to know and that helps meditation, is to know the different kinds of attention. So maybe almost like there's different species of attention. And different ones are useful in different vegetation zones, little microclimates, meaning that in different circumstances we find ourselves in, different forms of attention are useful. In different situations of inner climates of our mind, different attentions are useful. And we know that little bit, I think, well enough, if you think about it, that, if you are maybe at the beach and just kind of, just relaxed on the sand dunes and just kind of looking out across the ocean, it's a very different kind of attention being used than if you're at the grocery store and they've given you your receipt and you want to check and you think something's wrong. how much they're charging you, and use a very different kind of attention, to look at those numbers and figure it out. And, like it's very focused and attentive. It's not like, oh, look at these numbers. Wow, and numbers, human beings have had numbers for a while. They do wonderful things. And this is so inspiring that the grocery stores, they use these wonderful tools, numbers. Wow. It's like, it's a laser focus, and very attentive and for a purpose. Different situations, we use different kinds of attention, awareness. In meditation, the same thing. I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the main forms of attention that come into play when we meditate, with the idea that maybe you'll recognize these in yourselves. And as you start recognizing them, your own self, then they become more something that you can choose to use as it's needed. As opposed to one shoe fits all kind of approach to meditation. There's only one kind of attention. This is what you do. Sometimes you have people have the idea that that concentrated attention, that's what you're supposed to do. Just keep concentrating. And they have a very small, narrow idea of what concentration is, as opposed to that it's maybe a variety of different factors that are brought together. Some people have the idea that it's only about noting. It's only about recognizing what's there. And that's all you're allowed to do is recognize. And I've known people, maybe because their inner life was so challenged, who have used a technique of mental noting like a lifesaver. They're holding onto it for dear life. Because any giving up of that means that there's difficult inner life bubbles up and just makes life too chaotic or difficult. And so there's hanging on. And it's not really meditative attention. It's just like, just keep noting everything, what's going on, making a note, and it's just keeping everything at bay. And I've known people who practice who don't want to do any kind of directed attention. They don't want to do any kind of effort in it. They like things being effortless and relaxed and open and spacious. And maybe because their mind is usually the opposite, and so this is a relief. But sometimes, if that's all they do, there's not really learning what's in there. There's not really clear recognition. And some people drift off, sometimes for years, into some kind of, I don't know if stupor is the right word, but some kind of vague place. I've known people who have spent, I think someone recently said 25 years, in meditation regularly, and going into a very peaceful, spacious place where there was nothing there. And to spend 25 years in nothing, you know, no body, no world around them, kind of into kind of a blank place, is not very useful. There's probably not a lot of wisdom and learning that goes in that space, in that place, but it can be a welcome relief from the challenges of daily life. And some people go into those spaces sometimes because of the tremendous difficulty they've had in their lives, and they're really looking not to have to deal with that, and so they're looking for something that checks out or something. So there's a season for everything, and so there's a season, I think, for every type of meditation state and different ways of using attention. But I think it's a wise thing to start learning the different options and different ways that things can work and know when it's needed. So one of the if we're kind of getting to used to or getting wise about the inner landscape that comes into play when we meditate, you want to be able to notice the important landmarks that are there, and with the landmarks in mind, you can kind of begin following your way. And probably for most meditators, who are especially people in the beginning, one of the primary landmarks is to notice the particular species of thinking, which is distracted thought, that you're lost in thought. And some people come to meditation and have never a clue that they've ever been distracted ever in their life. They've never been lost in thought because they're just so lost that, you know, you don't know. And it's a bit of a shock for some beginning meditators to see how crazy it is in there, or how distracted they are, or caught up, and the momentum, strong current of being caught up, how that works. That's actually a very important landscape. It's like, you know, you notice a very important part of the terrain that you're exploring it and knowing it. If you go up in these preserves, especially this year, I think one of the really important things to recognize, more than probably for most of us, not all of you probably, but for most people, is to know to recognize poison oak. It's like exploded this year. And I've been a poison oak expert, because my wife gets poison oak very, very badly. So I've been an expert in our hikes to point it out to her. Watch out, it's there. And this year it's like hanging down above. I'm looking down at the ground, and it's hanging from above. It hits you in the face. And it's just like, you know, you have to, you know, it's like there to trap us. It's reaching out from to get us. So you know, it's good to know about the poison oak. It's good to know about these this phenomenon of distracted thought, getting lost in thought, because that's like going into the bushes where the poison oak is. You know, it's too easy to get caught and get caught up in places which sometimes not very ideal and useful for us or healthy for us to go into some of these places. And so to learn to recognize that and be cognizant of it. And one of the things we notice is these distracted thoughts. Sometimes it's not just that we're distracted, but there's a lot of momentum. There's a strong gravitational pull, or there's a strong drive in the mind to want to go there. And it's not just so. That's why it's difficult just to let go, because we let go, and the drive to think is still there. The emotional pull, push for it is there. And so something is needed to correct for that if we want to be present and not in that world. And there's two primary things that are useful. One is if it's possible to relax that momentum to keep thinking. So I often teach about relaxing the thinking muscle. So relax something, sometimes just relaxing physically, mentally, emotionally, there's less power in that distracted thought. The other is to counter it with a counterforce. And the counterforce is to use directed attention. And to have the attention be directed to something that's not distracted thinking. The most classic thing, I think, in Buddhist meditation is to direct the attention to breathing. It could be directing that there are other things as well, directing it to doing loving kindness, directing it to other forms of meditation, focuses. But as an act of choice, as an act of will, to direct the attention to something that's considered healthy or skillful. And as we do that, like stay on the breath, slowly the distracted attention, we're strengthening that capacity to stay present. We're strengthening capacity to have directed attention. And we're weakening slowly, bit by bit, the energy of distraction. Because every time you bring your attention back, it's the food of attention is going to feed that ability to have directed attention. Every time that you don't do that, you're feeding, attention is feeding distracted thoughts. So slowly you begin feeding one more than the other, strengthening one more than the other, and it can be a shift. Sometimes that shift happens in a single state of session of meditation. Sometimes that state, shifts and changes over a period of time or years of meditation, and people slowly begin to get the ability to stay more directed and stay present for the attention. And direct attention can take itself a number of different forms. And so if directed attention is the genus, then the species is different forms of directed attention. One of them is attention that simply knows what's happening. So you're there and you kind of know in some simple way. That's the breathing. I'm with the in-breath. That's the out-breath. And we know it. And so there's there can be, that knowing can be both active and passive. We can engage, we can direct the attention, and we can heighten that directedness by getting to know what's there, recognizing what's there. And so first it's kind of very simple knowing, but there can be a heightened knowing. And that heightened knowing in Pali is sampajana, clear comprehension, or I like the expression clear recognition. And this is a phenomenal capacity of the mind to not just kind of know what's going on, but clearly know what's going on. This is an in-breath. Or this is a distracted thought. This is a particular emotion. This is sadness. This is joy. But to really, really kind of, be very clear about their recognition. So when I'm walking up in the hills these days, before, I could recognize it was a tree. I'm not that lost. But now I clearly recognize, I was walking down here this morning, and some of these local native trees are on the, street trees. And I'm kind of in awe at this last couple of weeks with the black oaks. And when I was walking down the street, I said, oh, there's a black oak. I didn't know it was there. And that was pretty cool. And I clearly recognized it. Now that I'm paying attention, the other day, about a week or two ago, I said, I walked by a tree that I've walked by for 20 years, 25, long time, not 20 years, but I've been walking by it for about 17 years. And I walked by, I said, wait a minute, wow, this is a dawn redwood. You know about dawn redwoods? No? That's a really cool story. Can we do a little aside? And because it has a Buddhist association, this dawn redwood. It was a redwood that was thought to be extinct. In the 1940s, Chinese botanists found a few of them deep in the mountains in China. And the way I was told the story, the way it was preserved down through the centuries was in Buddhist monasteries. Because I guess the trees are not so uncommon for places to be deforested, but the Buddhist monasteries, the trees are kept there. And so at a Buddhist monastery, they found this Dawn redwood. It's a deciduous redwood. It doesn't grow that high. And so then in the late 40s, early 50s, it was brought to the United States and then disseminated the seeds, I guess, in different places. And I first learned about it from a Native American elder chieftain up in Marin County, who had been a botanist himself at UC Berkeley in the 50s. And he was one of the first people to get a little seedling or seed, and he planted it near Muir Woods. And so he took me to the tree and showed me the tree, and that was pretty cool. And so there it is, right here. If you come to the picnic, if you come to the picnic, I'll show it to you. How's that an incentive to have you come? It's in the park there. And so I clearly recognize this. And there's like, aha, there's this wonderful moment. Ah, I know this black oak, the Dawn redwood. So we have the capacity in the mind to watch what's going on in ourselves. So, oh, this is what it is. Wow, I'm angry. Now, that might not seem like a big deal, but clear recognition is very distinct from entangled recognition. Entangled recognition goes something like this. I'm aware that my body is uncomfortable in meditating. Yes, I recognize I'm uncomfortable. But I recognize it like this. Oh, it's so uncomfortable. Well, why am I meditating today? And why am I meditating at all? It's so uncomfortable. And, you know, and here, you know, probably I didn't do enough exercise. And I didn't do enough exercise because my parents didn't encourage me enough to exercise when I was a kid. And these parents that I have, and, you know, I really didn't grow up well. And, you know, this discomfort is like just their fault. You know, I'm entangled. I recognize, but I'm completely lost in a story and meaning and associations and all that. And unfortunately, and that's kind of a dramatic story, but it can be much more subtle, that entanglement, that involvement. It could be as simple as, I'm uncomfortable. It's my discomfort. You know, it's not yours, right? But it's not an innocent thing to call it my discomfort. It's if you really get still and quiet, you can feel the difference between just feeling it as discomfort versus my discomfort. So there's kind of entangled with this me, myself and mine. But to clearly know the simplicity of it, wow, this is discomfort. There's a way in which that recognition is not entangled. It's kind of like you step back enough and you say, wow, I see it for what it is. And one way to get to that is you want to experiment with it. Next time you get entangled in your mind with your favorite entanglement, or your mind's favorite entanglement, start using mental noting to start recognizing it. So like maybe it's distracted thought, distracted thinking. Just doing it that way doesn't do enough. You're still entangled with it. This is distracted thinking. Distracted thinking. And just kind of do it emphatically until the emphatic way of saying distracted recognition is clearly distinct from what's being recognized. It's like you really step back and there's a place in the mind that really recognizes it, which is not the same thing or not entangled with what's being recognized. So that's a little exercise that points to what's possible. That clear recognition, and when it's really done well, there's a kind of freedom in it. There's an independence from what is known. So one of the things we're looking for, one of the capacities we have in using attention, is attention that includes recognition. And that recognition can be very simple, or it can be very clear and powerful, the clear recognition. And to engage clear recognition it helps to be specific about what we notice in the mind. If it's all a blur, it's hard to have the kind of specificity of recognizing a black oak or a dawn redwood or whatever it might be. And so that's one kind of way of using attention. And that works very well sometimes if it's chaotic in here or if we're very distracted as a counter to all that. It also works very well in order to start seeing more clearly and not being entangled with things or reactive to things. But, you know, that's good. But then there are other forms of attention. And another one that the Buddha talks about is observing, anapasati, to observe, to look. And look has, the way I understand it, has a much more easily to be both an active and a passive thing to do. We can look very clear, you know, it's kind of close to clear recognition, but the focus now is not so much, maybe you already recognize what's there, and it's very clear what's there, but to look is to actively look more closely. And actually, what's really going on here? What's the nature of this thing that's going on? And so maybe you're looking at the dawn redwood, and as I did when I first got there, I wasn't sure, is this really a dawn redwood? And so I started looking more carefully at the leaves and at the bark and what was going on there until I convinced there was little, you know, seeds growing there, and until I kind of convinced myself this is it. So we can look. So even if something like breathing, you can be clear that you're breathing, but to really look closely, and that looking closely can be a microscopic look. Really look closely at where the breathing is most highlighted, and really look at the microscopic details of the sensations that come into play as you're breathing. And this is what we were expected to do when I did Vipassana in Burma, is to have a kind of a microscopic view on the experience. Other times, it's much more useful to look in a very passive and receptive way and have a kind of a macro lens. And we have, attention can be micro or macro. And to some degree, we can choose that. And sometimes you want to have a macro lens and not, you know, be boring in and having, you know, in close up, but take the wide angle lens and just kind of take in the whole scenery. Up in the local park here, there's a bench. You walk up and I'm looking at all the trees and everything plants now. And then I come to this bench that's kind of high up that overlooks the plain and the meadow and the trees, and I stop doing this fine detail looking then at the... Then I'm just kind of, you know, it's just beautiful to relax and settle back and take in the sky and the bay and the trees and the meadow that's there, and it's quite lovely. So that we have this, we have a capacity for a kind of attention that's wide-angled. And an observation which is not so active, looking carefully at something, but it's more just receptive, and it can be delicious to have this receptive mode and just allow things to be there and come and go as they do, provided that the mind is stable enough. Because it has to be, the forces of distraction have to be lessened. So, because otherwise, as soon as we go into kind of more of a passive receptive mode, the mind zips off into its preoccupation. And so sometimes we're using a form of attention that helps us get centered, helps us get less distracted, helps us to be in the present moment enough. And then we have more choice, and one of the choices then is to relax and open up. Generally, it's people who've meditated for a long time who have a greater and greater capacity for a non-directed attention, a receptive attention, a macro attention, that can be quite lovely to practice with, and that has its advantages because sometimes that can highlight all the ways in which we leave that. All the ways we get contracted. It can also sometimes make a lot of space and room in the mind and the heart for the movement of different forms of understanding, different forms of processing, for the unfolding and resolving of things in our life. From the inside out, our system can do it because it has a lot of space, a lot of room. We have breathing room for things to begin happening. So this observing can be close in, a close up, really take it in closely and see it. It could be a little bit further away, and it can be really far away. And that can be really useful to know you have that options when things are really difficult. Some things, meditation works best for some situations to be close up, and sometimes what works best is to back up really far. Fear is one of those where some people find if there's a lot of terror and fear when they sit down to meditate, being close up in the middle of fear is not useful. It kind of just kind of triggers even more of it. And so sometimes people who have a lot of fear in meditation learn to kind of step back and use their awareness to kind of lean back, and almost as if their awareness is two blocks away. And that distance, kind of looking at it, then it's safe to be with the fear. But close in doesn't work. And so the different forms of attention can include this close up and this far away. You know, where's the best place to be? The best to be really precise. I find sometimes with discomfort, I find it useful to be right close up, really right in the heart of where it's most uncomfortable. Sometimes with emotions, I find it useful to kind of be very broad and macro and just open to them. Different things, different ways of being at different times. And then what's interesting in terms of different kinds of awareness is the most famous awareness for our scene is mindfulness. But I think the word mindfulness, I don't really know what mindfulness is, even though I'm a mindfulness teacher. But I think that when I read the teachings of the Buddha, that the word that we translate as mindfulness, which is sati, is a much better to translate into English as awareness. And awareness, distinct from different forms of attention, is awareness is the underlying, basic, natural, kind of automatic capacity to be aware. It doesn't require attention, it doesn't require effort, it doesn't require choice and decision. The mind somehow will naturally be aware without you trying to do so. In fact, if you're listening to me and I tell you, I insist that you have to stop being aware, just cut it out. This is nonsense. You know, it's kind of hard to stop being aware. You know, it's just that's what the mind will do. And so when the Buddha talks about mindfulness, he never actually talks about it as something that we do. Oddly enough, given here in America, we talked about, practicing mindfulness. It's never something that's done, but rather it's something people rest in. It's people abide in awareness. And so the ability to abide in awareness takes a lot of self-understanding. You have to know the inner landscape. You have to know how not to get distracted. You have to learn how to establish a kind of centered attention, focused attention, to be really here in the present moment. And then when you're really rooted in the present, then you can kind of rest in an open, relaxed awareness. And the advantage of that is that to rest in this unself-conscious awareness, an awareness that we're not directing or doing, or that we're not the self, is not an agent for it, would really rest and be in that awareness. That sets the stage for, it's kind of like we've cleared the room from all the, I don't know if that's the right analogy, but we've kind of loosened all the ropes that keep us entangled. And so as they're loosened and loosened and loosened, then the knots can just unravel. But as soon as we are the agent, the one who's trying to do something, trying to accomplish something, some of those knots get tighter. And so one of the definitions that I like for what is the self, some people are like, what's the self? Buddhism says there's not supposed to be a self. What's the self? One definition I like is the self is a knot. And you can live with that knot, or you can untie it. And so as we rest in awareness, then these knots begin to disentangle. And as they're loose enough, then at some point the knots can just slip away from each other and the strings can be free. So there's directed attention and there's undirected attention. There is attention that involves recognition, knowing, and attention that involves clear recognition. There's a kind of attention that's more observing, watching, that can be close in or be far away. That can be passive and just kind of receptive, or it can be also active, kind of really directing the microscope to look someplace. And then there's attention that we have that is natural, a natural functioning of the mind, that if we have all the conditions have come together right, then it's something that we can rest in. And it really feels like we're resting or abiding in the sense of clarity and openness and just real presence that's there. And mostly what we need to do is to not mess it up. Mostly what we do then is not make ourselves aware, but mostly we recognize when we start getting pulled into thought, we let go of it. So it's mostly letting go back into it. Letting go back into it is if anything is needed. Because any attempt to do it is just tying more knots. So there's many more forms of awareness, but one of the things I wanted to convey today is, or try to pass on to you, is that you get interested in what do you do? Maybe rather than trying to learn what I taught today and then try to find out if you do it or start doing these things, take a good look. Chances are high that a good number of you have been, as meditators, have been, you know, taking that wonderful walk in the mental park. And it's kind of been a blur, all the things in there. Start looking, and what are you doing when you're paying attention? How do you engage your attention? And what are the different forms of attention you use in the course of the day? Do you use a different form of attention when you're doing your taxes than when you're driving? Do you use a different form of attention when you are going for a walk in the park or at the seashore or something from when you're making love? What are the different forms of attention that are operating for you, and how are they operating? And do you have, as you see the variety of different ways that knowing, attention, awareness, recognition are operating, what are you learning and what are you doing there? And I wanted to stop, but then I remembered one of the really important forms of knowing and awareness that I wanted to mention, and one of the ones that I think is really very important, I think, for this whole mindfulness or meditation, because the kinds of attention I was talking about now are all kind of mental. They're kind of in the mind kind of aspects of it. A whole other way of knowing and being aware is sensing, is to sense our experience. We have a lot of knowing or awareness, attention, has to do with how we take in a stimulus from the world around us or within us, how we take in the data that comes in. And so there's the mindfulness of the body where we're tuned into how things are being sensed physically is phenomenally important for a variety of different reasons, but one of them is that it takes us out of our head. And there's a lot of information that we acquire about this wonderful natural world of ourselves that's acquired by tuning into what's alive in the body, what's being stimulated, what's being released, what's being expressed in the body. And to sense the body gives us access to a tremendous amount of wisdom and processing. And that's another way of knowing, of being aware, is to sense the experience. And so I find it very, very useful sometimes to drop into the body and just know things through how they're felt in the body. Nothing more complicated than that. As I get better at it or more centered in my body, then I might bring in the recognition of what's there, and the two can operate together. So how much are you sensing your environment? How much are you sensing your own body in different circumstances? Is your body a resource? Does your body have any relevance in how you're with another person? I find it very helpful to be really in touch with my body when I'm having very important conversations with other people, because that's when I really need to track my emotions, my feelings, my responses, my reactions. And the early warning, the early way I discover that is through what's happening in my body. That's where the intuition kind of comes alive. So many ways of being aware, and there's more. Well, what do you do? That's your homework. What's your way? What are the different ways that you have? And as you become more conscious of the different ways, does that give you more choice? And do you have ways, can you recognize which form of your attentions are useful at different times? And if you begin learning about yourself, how it works for you this week, if you can, I'd encourage you to find someone, a friend, an enemy, a total stranger, it doesn't matter, and talk to them about what you're discovering. And, say, like, I'm discovering it's useful to do this here and this there and this kind of awareness, and see what, you can have some interesting conversations about this very important part of our life. So that's probably enough. Good? Thank you very much.